Rosh Chodesh Adar Beis, Sunday the 2nd of March, Rabbi Yehoshua Leib Hill, His Oribus. This week's Torah Way has been sponsored by Family Adler, Lichrod, the Aufruf of Yehoshua Adler, and also Lefur Shleimach of Reb Shimon Michoel Svi Ben Sorosh Cherna.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Can everybody hear me? Oh, I got to stand here. I can't pace. I'm a pacer. A little bit. How far can I go? This presentation is going to be a little bit unique. I'm a storyteller for children. So you'll have to excuse me. It is Ador, so, you know, it's going to be a little bit leicht, as they say. The name of this presentation is Mission Possible. Taking advantage, can you hear?
No.
You can't? Capitalizing on your everyday inspirations. Many of you do not know the message that I would like to carry. I'm going to use an interesting vehicle. Many of you do not know, I'm from the United States, you probably figured out from my accent by now, that my father is a very, very well-known film and television star. 30 years ago, he actually was here in Golders Green filming a famous film called Yentl. I would like to use his life story to bring across a certain message, and in Yitz Hashem, we will all be inspired. It's Rosh Chodesh Adar, Kol HaPoshev Yad, Noisnim Loi. It's a time for us to be inspired, and I'd like to inspire you, and of course myself, every time. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, if you give a speech to 1,000 people, and only one person is inspired, it's worthwhile, and even if the person that's inspired is yourself. So I grew up in New Square. My father was a Hasidic Yid. And you can well imagine, even though he was on television in the United States every single week, we didn't have a television in the house. So I'd like to share with you what it was like growing up behind the scenes, behind the curtain, as we say. The first week when he filmed this big show called Law and Order, the director, the producer of the show came over to me and he said, Mr. Hill, did you watch the show? He says, no, I didn't watch the show. And the next week again, he came over, he says, did you watch the show? He says, no, I didn't. I don't have a television, Dick. So the third week, he brought a big box. He says, we know you've been out of work. It was my father's a Baal Tshuva. He stopped acting for many years. He had a big box. He says, we brought you a television. We figured maybe you can't afford it. He says, no, I don't have a television for a reason, because although there's wonderful things on TV, I don't want my kids watching it. So we grew up not knowing anything about what my father did for a living. In 1991, he did a very, very big film in North Carolina with big names, Gedoyle Oilam, Dustin Hoffman, Bruce Willis, Mamish the Gedoylem, right? So my friend Velvi Tabak says to me, Yeshua Leib, it's not Kibud Av to not go watch your father's work. I've never seen any of my father's work. He would never like me to do that. He was very upset if I would go see something. So I said, Velvi, you know, my father really doesn't want me to see his films. He says, yeah, but, you know, you have to think. There's a mitzvah zeh d'oraisah, and kavod savicha, you know. He had a way with words. So basically, we rented a hotel room. There was no DVDs then, and there was no internet. So we rented, naughty, naughty boys, we rented a hotel room, and we rented this film, and we watched the movie that my father was in. It's a story about Dutch Schultz, a famous Jewish gangster, and my father plays his right-hand man, Otto Berman. He's the brains behind the gang. And they're indicted for tax evasion. So the big cop, you know, my father was the brains of the gang, says, you know what, we're going to move up to upstate New York. And in those days, wherever you were during the time of the trial, that's where they put you on trial. And we're going to behave real nicely, and the locals will think we're nice guys. And they'll get it. And that's kacha. That's right. It's based on a true story. They move up to Saratoga Springs. I'm rushing because I don't want to hold you up. So they move up to Saratoga Springs, and he gives all kinds of tzedakah to the local bingo. He actually baptized, and they put him on trial, and he gets off the hook. So during the movie, he goes down to where he lived in New York City, and there's a big victory party in the big hotel. He's upstairs speaking to his protege, and all of a sudden the door opens up, and my father walks in. And he's got this face on, and Dustin Hoffman says, what is it? My father says, they've issued another indictment. This time it's Dewey. Dewey's a famous prosecutor. He was running for president against Eisenhower.
And Dutch Schultz gets up. He's a terrible temper. He says, I want to know what time he comes out of his house. I'm going to kill that guy. I want to know where he lives. I'm going to get Dewey. My father says, you can't just kill Dewey. He's a prosecutor running for president. So he walks over to my father and he grabs him by the lapels. And he says, Otto, don't you ever tell me what I can and what I cannot do. You work for me. You do as I tell you. Is that clear? That's the scene. So I come home after watching the movie. I didn't say anything to my father. I had just gotten my license. I said, Tati, can I borrow the car? He says, no, you can't. I said, don't you ever tell me what I can and what I can't. He says, you saw the picture. Now, I'll tell you an interesting story that happened right here. Well, while he was filming Yentl and Golders Green, he was, I don't know if you filmed it, he stayed in Golders Green by Shlomo Fischer, so where I'm staying right now. So he came back, he was here for 10 weeks, he came back, I never say over this story, but I'm in London, so I can't hold it. So he comes back after 5 weeks to spend Shabbos with the kids back in Muncie. So he's filming with Barbara Streisand. We know who Barbara Streisand is from A Hole in the Head. We're Hasidic kids in Skver. What's Barbara Streisand? Who's that? We want to know about the Queen. So we're sitting around the Shabbos table, and one kid says, Tati, did you visit the Queen? And my mother says, don't be ridiculous. You can't just go into the Queen. And my little brother, Shmuel Hill, who's 6 years old, says, not even if you knock? He says, you can't go. So here's another interesting story that I share from you that's, so to speak, from behind the curtain. This same Velvi Tabak, we were going down from Muncie to Borough Park. You know, you can't buy this in your local department store. This is a Hasidish garb, so you have to go into Borough Park to purchase it. So on the way down, we're passing by Manhattan, and there is where they filmed this big show, Law and Order. So Velvi says to me, you know, we really should go visit your father. So I said, Velvi, you know, he'd be very, very upset, very discreet about his Yiddishkeit. This is not an industry where Yiddishkeit is very, encouraged. So he says, yeah, but, you know, kibedava, aim, the same argument. And he has a way with words, you know, as you know from the first time. And the next thing, I said, okay, we're going to go in, we're going to visit my father, but we're not going to say that we're related to him, because that's really going to make him upset. So we come in, two Hasidisha boys, you know, with Groyse Peis in Langerekel, and there's a secretary there, and we say, is it possible to meet Stephen Hill? That's my father's name. And I have a picture of him from the old days, from Mission Impossible, the Groyse show, right? So I have this picture of him. I said, we'd love to get his autograph. So she says, well, actually, he's not here now. He'll be shooting at 5 o'clock. You might want to come back later. So we go into Borough Park. We make our purchases. We come back 5 o'clock. The same secretary's there. So again, we say, you know, we'd love to get to meet Mr. Hill. She has no idea that I'm his son. So she says, okay, no problem. She starts taking us to the back. And my father had stopped acting for many years. You know, nobody really knew who he was. She says, you know, I'm kind of intrigued. He says, you know, interested in Stephen Hill, you know. Nobody knows who he is. You know, Michael Moriarty works. Yeah, I figure if you want to hear, you know, Paul Savini, these are big American film names. So I looked at her and I said that, you know, really, it's not me. My mother is a huge fan of his, I said to her. She said, oh, okay. And the last story I'd like to share, which is way back when he was doing Mission Impossible, He was in California shooting this. This is the biggest hit show in New York. And at that time, he was dating my mother. He was courting my mother in New York. So he comes to New York for Shabbos, and he's going to spend some time with my mother. Sunday night, he has a flight from Kennedy Airport. He's got to get back to Hollywood as quickly as possible. And Vashtetzach, like a good Hasidish Yid, he's late. So my mother's going to drive him, but she's afraid. She has this jalopy car. She's the daughter of a Rav. And she asks her Aunt Bella if she could follow along in case they break down. Because they're flying down the Belt Parkway. It's pouring rain. And like a self-fulfilling prophecy, the car breaks down. And it's right under the street lamp. My father runs and he grabs the packages from one. He's running, his hair's in his face, and he's running from one car to the other. They jump into Aunt Bella's car, they fly off to Kennedy Airport, they get there by the skin of their teeth. The next day, Bella is sitting in her cubicle in Manhattan, and she hears two ladies talking. And one lady's saying to the other, Sadie, you're not going to believe what I saw yesterday. She says, what'd you see? They were filming Mission Impossible on the Belt Parkway, she says. I saw it with my own eyes. That's the behind-the-scenes stories. Now I'd like to share with you a little bit how he became a Frumayid. And Be'ezus Hashem, we'll all be able to draw from this story. I was sitting with my father, this goes back 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, on a park bench in Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh. And I don't know how many of you have been to Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh, but the stars seem closer in Yerushalayim than they seem anywhere else in the world. It's almost as if you could reach up and touch them. And we're both sitting on a park bench, staring at the star-filled sky, and my father, the old man, begins to mumble. He says, "Stars. Stars. Movie stars. I was on the cover of Time magazine. I was on the cover of People magazine. I was on the cover of the TV Guide. I was in Marlon Brando's class. And my teacher liked me better. Do you want to know what happened?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "We were filming a movie in 1961 in San Francisco, California. I was playing the part of a CIA agent. And the part that I had at that particular scene was to come out of a building, get into a car. Car goes down the hill, disappears to the left. The way it works in movies, things aren't always on schedule. I didn't start filming this particular scene until 1 o'clock in the morning. They put on the makeup, they set up the lights, they set up the whole scene. I come out of the building, I get into the car, I go down the hill. I come back up, I say to the director, 'How did you like the shot?' He says to me, 'Steve, you're coming out of the building, you look like you were sleepwalking. You got to come out with a little bit more pizzazz. You're a CIA agent. It was 1 o'clock in the morning.' You know, he blamed me. I said, 'Let's do it again.' By the time they set up the scene and get everything prepared again, it is now 2:30. And we shoot the scene for a second time. I come back up, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, 'How'd you like the scene, Greg?' He says, 'There's a problem. Down at the bottom of the hill, there's a street lamp that's obscuring the view of the camera. We sent a crew down. It shouldn't take more than a half an hour. We'll shoot the scene a third time.' They send a crew down. A half an hour turns into an hour and a half, and it's now 4 o'clock in the morning. They're getting ready to shoot the scene for the third time. I get into the car. I go down the hill. I come back up. I say, 'Greg, how did you like the shot?' He says, 'Steve, it was perfect. Let's do it one more time for good luck.'" That's the way it was. I don't know if you know, but I've made a couple of movies myself. So they put the makeup on. They set up the shot. It is now straight up and down, 5:30 in the morning on a Sunday morning, 1961, in San Francisco, California. He says, "I start going down the hill for the fourth time that night. And as I'm going down the hill," he says, "I could see the sun is coming up on the horizon." And he looks at me, he says, "And at that point I realized, there's more to life than cars, cigars, and movie stars. Hollywood was my religion," he said. "I got kicked off 3 plays in Broadway because I felt that the director wasn't being honest to the writer's intent. This was it for me. This was my religion. But now I realize there's something else." I come back up, and the director sees there's something bothering me. I say, "Do you mind if I take a 1 week sabbatical? I have to go back up to Seattle, Washington, where I grew up." I hadn't been in Seattle, Washington for 9 years. I rent a car. And I go to check out my old neighborhood, my high school. But instead of a high school, there's a shopping center. So I go check out my middle school. That I don't know if it's the same language here in Europe, right? The middle school is where the... And he goes to check out the middle school, and there's a big factory where they're building Boeing 747 aircraft. So now with quite a bit of trepidation, he says, "I go down to my grammar school, which is the lowest grade in the United States." He says, "I'm shocked because there's nothing but an empty cornfield." And he looks at me and he says, "And I realized at that point that I'm a man without a past. And a man without a past is a man without a future." I come back home. My father's an old Russian Jew. I don't know how many old Russian Jews you know, but they don't talk a whole lot. And he sees there's something bothering me. And he says, "Sal, why don't you come to shul tomorrow?" The next day is Shabbos. So I come with my father to the Bikur Cholim Shul, 1961, Seattle, Washington. I walk into the shul. It smells exactly the same, like 40 years ago. The same green carpet leading up to the Aron Kodesh. The faces of the old men as if they hadn't changed in 40 years. I stand next to my father. And I'm holding the siddur. I know how to daven, but I can't. There's a whirlwind going on in my head. This place is for real. This place is forever. After the davening, the locals come over and they're saying good Shabbos, but I can't hear what they're saying. There's a tsunami in my mind. My father doesn't say a word to me. We walk out of the shul. And I'm about 100 yards away from the shul, and I decide that I'm going to take one last look at this unbelievable place. And there in the stained glass windows, there's a pasuk. Manoira mokoy mazeh, how awesome is this place? Ein zekiyim beis elokim. This is the house of the Ribbono shel Olam. V'zeh shaar ha-shamayim. This place is for real. This place is forever. And thus begins a 5-year metamorphosis. But the lesson that I'd like to share with you is an age-old lesson. And we can always learn from it, like the Mesillas Yeshurim says, the simple things we always forget. Stephen Hill is tremendously inspired. He sees the sun coming up. But he does something about it. Inspiration is only when we do something about it. It's an age-old lesson, but it's never, you can never hear it enough. He makes a move. He says, I want to go up to see. He doesn't know what he's doing. During this 5-year metamorphosis, will he become a Ben Torah? He is on a play in Broadway, playing the part of Sigmund Freud. Echet HaGreise Tzadik. Right? He's playing the part of Sigmund Freud. The lady that's starring opposite him is an actress from German descent. This is in the early 60s. The wounds of the war are very fresh. And she's playing the part of an Austrian. Also not the greatest tzaddikus, of course. And that Dr. Freud is psychoanalyzing her, and the climax of the play is an 8-minute monologue where Freud will explain to this woman that the reason she cannot use her legs is not because of a physical fallacy. It's because of an emotional problem. And he points to her and he says, because you were in love with that man and he rejected you. And the pain from the truth is so gripping that she sits up in her seat and she slaps him across the face and she says, you Jew! Freud was a Jew. And the whole audience goes, And years later, my father would say, what a sense of humor the Ribbono shel Olam has. Here I'm trying to debate whether or not to identify with my Yiddishkeit. And 9 times a week, because he got matinee, I'm being slapped across the face in front of 1,500 people being called a Jew. But the lesson, every slap, he only eats fish. Another slap, only vegetables. Slowly but surely, every slap, he comes closer and closer to Yiddishkeit. The Yesoid is that when we are inspired, and he was inspired, we have to do something with that inspiration. Rosa shifcha alayam mashloi ro yecheskel ben buzi. So the Bali Musar asked the obvious kasha, how could she be called a shifcha? How could she be called, or she should be called a rebbetzin? Why do we call her a shifcha? The Torah says, yes, she saw more than ma'isim merkavah. She saw incredible things. But what did she do with the inspiration? She didn't do anything with it. So she remained what she was, and that was a shifcha. There's an incredible story that I heard that goes along with a beautiful vart. It says, Vayevk Yosef al Tzavrei Binyamin, Ubinyamin Bocha al Tzavarev, when they see each other for the first time after 22 years. Zot Rashi, Vayevk Yosef al Tzavrei Binyamin, because he saw both Botei Migdash that are going to be built in the Chelik of Binyamin, but unfortunately they're going to be destroyed. And Binyamin cries because he sees the Mishkan Shila that's going to be built, Bechel Geshel Yosef, and it's going to be destroyed. Frech Tzachta Avi Shaila. Yosef cried for your Mishkan Shile. Binyamin cried for your Beis HaMikdash. Why are you crying for his problems and he's crying for your problems? In the early 1950s, during the height of the communist regime, there's an old Yid in Russia. There's a group of refuseniks that get together for Shalosh Shudos every week. And they invite this old Yid to come to some bombed out cellar to give them chizik, to bring chizik for Idid. So he comes to this little cellar and they have a half an egg and a crusty piece of bread and they're praving the Shalosh Shudos and they're singing and then it's time for him to speak and he begins to speak. And he's talking and he's being more oirer than to the tchikipon, their fight for Yiddishkeit. And he stops for a moment to catch his breath. And he can hear they're crying. They're so nisoirer about this that they're crying. He can literally hear them crying. And then he continues. And about 5 minutes later, there's a knock on the door. And a knock on the door in the 1950s means KGB. In 2 seconds, the swarm are under the floorboards. They're out the back window. They get away by the skin of their teeth. He sends a message. He says, the next time you get together, he says, I want to come. So the next time they get together, 3-4 weeks later, they find a different bombed out basement. They invite this old Yid. He comes in and he says, I want to say one thing. Last time I was here, I spoke and I stopped to catch my breath. And I can hear the Olam was Meredik Nisoyer, you were crying. He says, but when the KGB knocked on the door, nobody cried. Everybody knew exactly what to do. When it comes to Gashmias, we know what we have to do. When it comes to Ruchnias, we kvetch. Oy gewalt, medaf episton. The Yesoid is, we have to do something with our inspiration. Yesterday, punkt, Rav Zimmerman from Gateshead said an unbelievable word that mamish works perfectly over here. He says, we know everything that happened during the Mishkan, the first two parshias, Terumah and Tetzaveh. Why do we have to have another two parshias? 214 psukim. What do we need 214 psukim to say exactly what he said before that? So he said over from Rabbi Yonis Naipshitz, the first two parshias where they were told do. The second two parshias, 214 tells us that they actually did it. So Rabbi Yonis Naipshitz, that's the chiddush. That's a chiddush that the Torah needs to tell us in 214 psukim, from being inspired to do to actually carrying out. That's a chiddush that's worth 214 psukim. I used to say over this story quite often to Friar people. Originally I worked for Beis Medrash Gevoyer for the Lakewood Yeshiva, and I spoke a lot for senior citizens. That's how I know how to speak so loud. So they used to look at me and say, Rabbi Hill, you're saying, you know, but you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. So I want to share a story with you. I'll try to make it the quickest because I've got 5 minutes left. It's a famous story, but it's kedai to hear it again because you're thinking, you know, we're inspired, but you know, unbelievable story. I heard it from Rabbi Chil Spiro, the author of the Touched by a Story. He heard it from the boy that it happened to. You may know the story, but like I said, it's worthwhile to hear it again. This goes back about 6-7 years ago. There's a boy, his name is Mordechai Kaler. He lives in Silver Spring, Maryland. And he decides this year, instead of going to summer camp, he's going to go to the local nursing home and he's going to volunteer. He comes to the local nursing home and he has a pair of tefillin. After a couple of weeks, he gets to know who the frum residents are. He asks one person, would you like to put on tefillin? Some say yes, some say no. He walks into a room of a Mr. Gansfried. He says, Mr. Gansfried, would you like to put on tefillin? Mr. Gansfried says, get out of my room and don't you ever come back here again. So he backs up, he's out of the room, but he's a kid with courage. He walks back into the room. And he says, Mr. Gansfried, if you don't want to put on tefillin, that's your prerogative, that's fine. But why are you yelling at me? He says, how old are you? He says, I'm 16. He says, what's your name? He says, Mordechai. He says, Mordechai, sit down. When I was 12 and a half years old, my entire family was taken to Auschwitz. 6 months later, everybody was dead but me and my father. It was the night of my bar mitzvah. My father said to me, there's one man here that has a tefillin shel yad, but three barracks down, there's a Mr. Bloomberg, he has a tefillin shel yad and a tefillin shel resh. I'm going to get the tefillin shel yad and the tefillin shel resh so that in your bar mitzvah you can put it on. So on the cover of darkness, as all of Auschwitz tries to sleep, this man makes his way. He says, I stood by the window, my breath was fogging up the glass, and I waited for what seemed like a lifetime. My heart was pounding so hard, it felt like an atom bomb was going off every second. And all of a sudden, I could see the silhouette of my father coming back. And as he's getting closer, the floodlights go on. I start screaming at the top of my lungs. I run as quickly as I could. And I'm 10 feet away from my father when he's gunned down by the Nazi machine gun. And the Nazi looks at me, and he sees the tefillin in my father's dead hand. He says, you want the tefillin? You can have the tefillin. And he kicks them over to me. I pick up the tefillin, I look up, and I say, I hate you! It's the day of my bar mitzvah! How could you do this to me? He says, I swear I will never put on tefillin. And I swear that no Jew will ever touch these tefillin. He says, now do you understand why I told you to get out of my room? Now get out! He's backing up out of the room. Mr. Gottfried says, wait. You see the dresser on the left? Open up the top drawer. He opens the top drawer. He says, those are the tefillin. Oh, children.
At what part did I lose you? Should I start again?
He says, now you understand why I told you to get out of my room? He says, open up the dresser, and in the top drawer is the tefillin. The boy leaves, and for the next 2 weeks he doesn't go into that wing. Forget about that room. But 2 weeks later, there is someone in the nursing home that has to say Kaddish for his father, who was killed, shot, in Auschwitz. He tries to get a million together, he only has 9 people, he needs a 10th person, and he braves it, he walks in to Mr. Gansfried's room, and Mr. Gansfried looks at him, he says, what do you want? He says, we have 9 people, someone here has a father who was shot in Auschwitz, can you please come and be the 10th person on the minyan? Mr. Gansfried thinks for a little while, and he says, do you promise me that you will never ask me about anything that relates to Judaism ever again? He says, I promise. Mr. Gansfried comes, and there are 10 people on this minyan, and this man is able to say Kaddish. The next day, Mordechai walks out of the elevator. He looks down the hall, and he sees the most incredible thing. Mr. Gansfried is sitting in his wheelchair. He's wearing tefillin, and he's caressing the ritzuas, and he's weeping. And Mordechai says, I got to hear what he's saying. And he walks up behind him and he listens in and he hears he's saying, Oi, Tate, it feels so good. Oi, Tate, it feels so right. This goes on for 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, he walks out of the elevator, the lift, and he takes a look down. And he gets a sick feeling in his stomach because the wheelchair is empty. He starts running down the hall looking for a nurse. They say he just went to community hospital. They just took him out a half an hour ago, maybe 45 minutes ago. He runs 3 blocks to community hospital. He runs up 3 steps in a row. He gets to room 512, 515, 517. There's a middle-aged lady sitting outside the door. He says, is this Mr. Gansfried's room? She says, are you Mordechai? He says, yes. She says, I'm Denise Gansfried. Mr. Gansfried was my father. I want to tell you something. He used to wake up in the middle of the night with nightmares screaming. I never saw my father smile in 50 years, but this morning as they carried him out of the nursing home, he said to me, Denise, the tefillin in the top drawer. And this morning, my father passed away with the tefillin on his head and the first smile I ever saw on his face. And I want to thank you for that. And I'll close with perhaps even a more powerful story. 1973, perhaps you heard the story, but again, like I said, in the right matziv. 1973, there's an atheist soldier from the Upper Galilee. He doesn't believe in God at all. He's in a foxhole. There's a famous rule. There's no atheist in a foxhole. He looks up to Rabbi Shalom. He's surrounded by Arabs. He says, look, there's no atheist in a foxhole. There's a rule, but there's an exception to every rule. I don't believe you exist, but I'll make you a deal. If you save my life, but not a regular saving my life, I want a bullet in my hand so I can never fire a rifle again, and I will join a yeshiva, and I will learn what it means to be a yid. To make a long story short, one of the last bullets fired in 1973 hits this soldier right in the hand. He comes home, he says to his mother, he says to his father, I don't have a choice. They're both bleeding heart atheists. They say, you don't have a choice. You have to go to yeshiva. He says, I'm going, but I'm in the middle of agricultural school. I have 3 months, I'll finish up agricultural school and then I'll go to yeshiva. He goes to agricultural school and he never goes to yeshiva. And to this day, there's an agricultural inspector walking around the sunny fields of southern Israel. He's got a bullet hole in his hand. He's a total atheist. The Rabbeinu Shlomo spoke with him. The Rabbeinu Shlomo was intimate with him. He made the decision to do it, but he didn't take action. Es ahahava achetechpots. We need to take action. So here's the question. When's the last time we were inspired? Perhaps it was Rosh Chodesh Adar, when the wind blew in a children's storyteller into Start Your Tay the Torah way. I was definitely inspired from saying these stories. And my hope is that you were inspired from telling these, from hearing the story. But the problem is like this. If when the speech is over, you turn to the Yid next to you and you say, you know, for a children's storyteller, he's not bad. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Then we have failed. Because we're not here to entertain you. I'm a children's entertainer. We're not here to get you, or to get ourselves, myself included, to think, because thinking is a waste of time. The question is, what are we going to do about it today? If you want some suggestions, I'm working on a big project and you can approach me afterwards. But everybody could do their own Kabbalahs, and my hope is, and my tefillah is from the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, that we should all be zoicha to do something meaningful today. A Kabbalah, Yom Kippurim, it's a time to make Kabbalahs. I thank you very much. You are a wonderful audience. Yeah.